Good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. If you are hearing the sound of my voice, you should be here for a Kluwen Internet Seminar, which has been entitled Renewable Energy on Potentially Contaminated Land. This is a webinar series, the first one in the series, which is going to focus on an introduction of EPA's Repowering America's Land, which has been sponsored by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Center for Program Analysis. My name is Jean Mallett, and I work here at the EPA in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I will be helping to moderate today's session. Again, we're going to give a few latecomers a couple extra minutes to hop on the line with us. And while we do that, we're going to cover some housekeeping items for everyone. As a reminder, as I mentioned earlier, when you registered for today's session, you would have received a confirmation message on your screen, as well as a reminder and confirmation email from me, which had links to today's seminar homepage. On that seminar homepage, you were able to read a complete description of our session, as well as look at who would be speaking, read some of their bios, as well as find contact information for them, as well as myself. On that seminar homepage, again, there are links to either go to the seminar to look in your web browser or to download the slides in a few different formats, depending on your preferences. That material will be available for indefinitely, so you can always refer back to that homepage if you like, if you have follow-up comments or questions after today's session. For those of you who are joining us on the phone lines, just a reminder that we ask that you put your phone on hold. You can either use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your line. We do have time for question and answer designated with the instructors, but that's going to be held until the end of the formal presentation. So until then, we will ask that you keep yourself on mute by hitting *6. We also remind you don't put the call on hold. Sometimes you may have commercials or advertising or music that will run in the background on hold. So that could disrupt our call today. Just if you do have to place the call on hold, you can go ahead and hang up and redial in. There won't be an entry or exit tone, so it won't disable us. So again, just keep us on mute. Don't put us on hold. I'm going to ask everybody who should now be looking at the slides to move past the title slide, which is slide number one, onto slide number two, which is covering over a couple more housekeeping items before we formally begin today. You will be required, as in all Kluwen Internet seminars, to manually move through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. If you are looking at the slides online, you'll have two options. You can use the numbered links that appear to the left to move through the slides at cues from the instructors, or you can use the icons that appear above the top of the slides. There should be a series of orange circles above them. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. The icon with the house on it will bring you to the seminar homepage. The other icon of interest there is a button that has a question mark in it. You want to be sure that your pop-up blockers have been disabled, and if you click on that, a new window will open up, which will give you the opportunity to type up or comment or electronic questions. Those questions will be submitted in the background to myself, and I'll be able to read those out loud to the instructors on your behalf at the appropriate time at the end of today's presentation. You don't have to wait until the end of the session to submit those comments. You can do that at any point in time throughout today's presentation, and in fact, we encourage that to make sure we'll be able to address the questions in a timely fashion. You can also use that question mark icon even if you're streaming or if you're listening to us by phone, if you're more comfortable typing up your comments or questions, by all means. And that's also the same way you can report technical difficulties if you experience anything. Our support staff will also monitor that queue and will work with you to troubleshoot your issues as long as you provide a phone number where we can reach you. The last thing I'm going to point out, actually two more things before we begin. We are going to, at the end of today's session, point you to a resources page where you'll be able to download the slide as well as a few other references that have been accumulated for today's event. And then a feedback form, which we will ask you to take a minute or two to fill out. We do read each and every one of those comments when they're submitted, and that's how we make sure that we continue to improve our deliveries like this on Kluwen. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today, I highly encourage you to fill out that feedback form because you can check a box and have a confirmation email sent to you for your records. The last reminder I have before I formally kick things off today is that the session is being recorded and will be archived on the Kluwen website within 1 to 2 weeks. If you visit kluwen.org/training and follow the links for archived seminars, you'll be able to browse the catalog of over 300 archived trainings that we've given over the years here on Kluwen. You can download them in a few formats, or if you prefer, you can even find us on iTunes and subscribe to our free podcast there. So with the end of those reminders, I think we're ready to officially kick things off for today's session. Again, the overview for today's session is that through its Repowering America's Land Initiative, the EPA is encouraging renewable energy development on current and formerly contaminated land and mining sites. EPA has identified thousands of acres of brownfield, Superfund, mining, and other potentially contaminated sites with potential for utility-scale solar facilities. Siting renewable energy facilities on brownfields offers significant benefits to communities. Many brownfields have infrastructure in place, such as transmission and water lines, thereby reducing the need for local government investments. Renewable energy can provide a reuse option for brownfields that don't have other viable uses or are located in sensitive communities. It also avoids development of greenfields that might otherwise be used to site these facilities. In addition, these facilities may generate tax, land use, and royalty revenues and provide construction and maintenance jobs. During today's session, Laura Matthews will provide an overview of how siting renewable energy on brownfields benefits communities and how local governments can strategically plan for renewable energy siting on contaminated sites. Kevin Mayer of EPA's San Francisco office and Josh Perkow of Apex Wind Energy Axio Power will present case studies of projects where they successfully sited uncontaminated properties. So our first speaker, again today, who is Laura Matthews from the EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response in the Center for Program Analyses, is a project lead for EPA's Repowering America's Land. Laura basically has been here at EPA since July 2006, where she worked on climate change issues relating to land and materials management for several years. Ms. Matthews has a Master's in Public Policy from Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs and a BA in Economics from Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Our second speaker today is Kevin Mayer, again from EPA's office in Region 9, where he has been a Superfund project manager for over 20 years in the EPA's Region 9 office. Kevin's Superfund management experience includes cleanup of several very large groundwater contamination sites in California. He currently oversees Leviathan Mine and Aerojet Superfund sites and three other Superfund sites in Northern California. He participates in a number of national and regional research and technical advisory groups on perchlorate, mining, and other emerging issues. Kevin is a registered civil engineer and holds graduate degrees in environmental engineering from Stanford and in soil and science and microbiology from the University of Washington. His BA is from Rice University. And then our third and final speaker today is Josh Perkow, who is a project manager at both Apex Wind Energy and Axio Power. He joined DQ Energy in 2006 as an entry-level engineer, where he assisted in construction management of the 20 MW Steel Winds project, led the Phase 1 development efforts at the 14-megawatt Kenai Wind project, which has construction starting in 2010, and the 50-megawatt Sunray Wind project operational fourth quarter of 2008. And just a reminder, if you're on the phone line, please mute. I can hear some background discussion. Again, it's star 6 to mute your line. Okay. Back to Josh. Mr. Burkow transitioned to Apex and Axio with the acquisition of BQ Energy in 2009 and now leads development activities at a number of brownfield and industrial sites across the country. With his background as an electrical engineer, he leads technical aspects of many Apex and Axio's portfolio projects, including transmission studies, procurement of inverters, PV modules, and wind turbines. In 2007, he received his Master's of Science from the State University of New York at Buffalo, where he studied electrical power engineering and the breakdown of electrical insulators. So with those introductions and one final request and reminder, please mute your phone lines by hitting star 6. I need everybody on the phone line to mute, hit star 6.
Bye.
Okay, guys, what I'm going to do, because I can't get that individual to mute their line, is I'm going to globally mute. So the instructors, as we worked out earlier today, you're going to hear a message that everything's been globally muted. And at that point, once you hear the global mute, I'll ask that the instructors only hit pound 6 so they can unmute and continue to talk.
The leader has muted your line.
So again, instructors, starting with Laura, if you could please hit pound 6 to unmute.
Can you hear me, Jean?
I can indeed. And with that, just a reminder, Kevin and Josh, you'll have to do the same thing when it's your turn. And I'll officially segue over on slide number 3 to Laura.
Thanks, Jean. As Jean mentioned, my name is Laura Matthews. I work for EPA as the lead for Repowering America's Land, EPA's initiative to promote the siting of renewable energy on potentially contaminated land and mine sites. I'm really happy to have Kevin Mayer from our Superfund office in Region 9. He's going to present a case study on the Aerojet site out in California where they've sited solar on a site that's being cleaned up for the with the groundwater contamination. And also we have Josh Gurko, who will be talking about a wind site outside of Buffalo. And I will be presenting an overview of the initiative. So today I will be giving you information on what is the Repowering America's Land Initiative. I will explain why EPA is focused on siting renewable energy on contaminated sites. I'll tell you a little bit about some of the existing repowering tools that we have, explain the feasibility studies that we're doing with Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab, and tell you about next steps at EPA under the initiative. So moving on to slide number 5, EPA launched the Repowering America's Land Initiative about 2 years ago in 2008. Under our authority to investigate, assess, and clean up contaminated sites, we also promote redevelopment at these sites. And we realize that some sites may have potential for renewable energy. Not all sites are ideal for siting solar or wind. Other sites might be better suited for more conventional redevelopment opportunities. Sites that could be used for renewable energy include brownfield sites, Superfund, abandoned mine lands, RCRA corrective action, and landfills. To date, we've mapped over 15 million acres. That's about 11,000 sites, and we've overlaid that with renewable energy potential. And that picture you see in slide number 5 is actually of the Lackawanna project that Josh is going to be talking about in a short while. So moving on to slide 6, EPA is promoting the siting of renewable energy on contaminated sites because we think that it makes sense both as a redevelopment option to protect green space and a way to provide some incentives and jobs and tax revenue for the communities. So many of these sites offer elements that are attractive to developers and those who are working in the renewables field. A lot of them have existing infrastructure. So there are transmission lines that are going right up to these sites. Because many of these sites are old industrial sites that are no longer in use, they often have excess capacity on those transmission lines. There are often roads and railways that go to these sites. There's a potentially lower transaction cost for these sites. And one thing that we've seen is that there's often improved public support for using these sites and faster time frame for permitting and zoning these sites. If you think about an old site that has been vacant for 20 years, the community living around that site may be much more amenable to putting a solar or wind project on the site than a green space site. And for the local governments and the communities surrounding these, many of these sites have a number, siting renewable energy on these properties has a number of benefits, including increasing the economic value for the property, maximizing land use by using land that has been prior used instead of green space, reduces the stress on green fields, and provides energy, clean energy for use on site locally or to the grid, and it may also create local jobs. So if you look at slide 7, I have a map here of the potential for solar. And so all these dots are different types of contaminated properties. For example, yellow are abandoned mine lands, and then the purple dots are brownfields. So in the southwest part of the country, these are the traditional parts of the U.S. that have good solar resource potential. You see that dark brown and the light brown parts are places that the economics for solar make sense with good solar resource shining down on there. Then you also see a couple states in the Midwest and then quite a few states in the Northeast that have dots where contaminated sites are. Now, these are places where the state has decided that solar energy is important to meeting their renewable goals. So they have specific policies in place that have either mandated or encouraged solar development. For example, states like New Jersey and Pennsylvania have a a requirement that renewable energy be a certain percentage of the electricity in that state, and then they further say that a smaller percentage of that has to come from solar. And so states that aren't traditionally thought of as good for solar are seeing a lot of solar development because of those solar policies. And so this map shows the potential across the country in states with good policies in place, and you can see that there are, about 450 sites that look like they're good for PV just based on the resource, and then when you add in the policy-driven, the number is over 1,000. And then you can put solar PV really anywhere, and so that's what that 11,000 number is. That's all the sites that we have lat-long data for. And finally, there are certain sites in the Southwest that are good for concentrated solar power, and it looks like we have about 85 that have potential for Sterling concentrated solar power and 60 with potential for trough concentrated. And slide 8 shows a similar map for wind. You can see that there are about 37 sites across the country that look like they're good for really big utility size projects, and then there are another 170 sites about that look like they have the potential for smaller community scale size projects. And then there are about 1,000 sites that have potential for much smaller wind projects. So moving on to slide 9, I'd like to take a minute to tell you about some of the repowering tools. One of, I think, the tool that people use a lot is our Google Earth mapping tool. I'll show you what that looks like in just a minute. But we worked with NREL to screen all of our sites and determine which ones have the potential for renewable energy, and we have that posted on our Google Earth tool. We also have information on technical assistance available. We have success stories online, and currently a lot of those are short one- or two-page fact sheets, and we're working on developing more robust case studies that really go through the process of how these projects were developed, some of the hurdles that they may have hit, and how they overcame those barriers. And finally, we have information on incentives for both cleaning up sites and for renewable energy for each state. And you can find all of that on our website at epa.gov/renewable-energy-land. So on slide 10, I'll tell you a little bit more about our Google Earth mapping tool. We mapped all of those contaminated sites that I mentioned before. For the brownfields properties, we only have those brownfield sites that EPA has given a grant to. So we only have information about 4,000 brownfield sites across the country. There are, hundreds of thousands of more brownfield sites, but we only have lat-long data for those sites we've given grants to. So we worked with Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab. We used their wind and solar and biomass resource data, and we overlaid that information with the acreage for our sites and then the distance of those sites to transmission lines and highways and roads. So slide 11 shows an example of the Google Earth mapping tool. You can see the dots are similar to the static maps I showed you earlier, but this map is something that you can actually zoom into. So on the left, you can see a bar that shows you different types of renewable energy. So depending on your interest, you can click just the type of renewable energy you're interested in, for example, community wind or PV, utility solar. And moving on to slide 12, this zooms in on Arizona, and you can see there are the sites here are similarly differentiated by the type of project. So if you can click on any one of those dots, and then when you do, a pop-up box comes up. This is what is shown in slide 13. So there's a lot of information on the site in this pop-up box. You can see that this site, the former Tri-City landfill, is 140 acres. You can see where it's located, what type of program it is. It's a brownfield. In that little box, it shows what type of renewable energy it has may be good for this site. So this example has concentrated solar, utilities, scale solar, et cetera. Below that, it has specific information on the resource available at that location. And then if you look right above that box that has the different types of renewable energy potential, there's a link you can click on to cleanup program information. And when you click on that link, a web page comes up, and EPA has a website for each of the different properties we track. And so when you click on that, you'll get even more site-specific information about how far this site is along in the cleanup process, who you can contact at EPA to get more information, and it often has information about who the site owner is and who to contact at the site owner's firm, or if it's with the city, then who to contact at the city. And in addition to having this information available in the Google Earth tool, we also have an Excel spreadsheet that you can download from the website. All of the Google Earth tool and the Excel spreadsheet, all of this is, free and right on our website. And so the Excel spreadsheet lists all of these properties by state. And so you can just, you know, look at multiple properties in Excel sheets so you can sort by size or the type of renewable energy that you're interested in. And we also have that information available in a GIS format for those of you that work with GIS software. So on slide 14, I'd like to tell you about a partnership we have with the National Renewable Energy Lab. In addition to the work we did with them a couple years ago to screen our sites, we recently partnered with them to evaluate the feasibility of siting renewable energy on some specific sites. And about a year ago, we chose 12 site-specific projects we're working on, and you can find out information about that on our website as well. We have a little one-page fact sheet for each site. And the analysis will determine what the best renewable energy technology is for that site, the optimal location on that site for renewable energy, how much energy could be generated, the return on the investment, and the economic feasibility of the renewable energy project. So at the end of the day, NREL will be developing reports for each of these sites, and that will be a tool for the community or for the landowner to use when they're seeking developers for the site. You know, they'll be able to have that information available when trying to attract developers. And I'd like to take a minute on slide 15 to tell you about one of those feasibility studies in Puerto Rico. I think this is, even though it's in Puerto Rico, I think it has applicability to a city or a region or a state who's examining multiple properties. So in Puerto Rico, NREL is analyzing the feasibility of siting solar PV on a number of landfills across the state. And so what NREL did was they did a site visit and looked at a number of landfills, and they also looked at criteria before they did the site visit to determine which landfills to go to. That included information on acreage, distance to roads and transmission lines, slope, and then when the landfill will close. So they visited 8 landfills, and it looks like about 7 of those will be feasible for solar PV. On the other landfill, the slope was too steep, so that one isn't feasible for solar. So what they're currently working on, and I believe the final report for this will be coming out probably within the next month, is they are going to talk about each of the landfills, talk about how large the system can be there, what the different options are, talk about the economics, and highlight some of the financing options available for Puerto Rico. So keep your eyes on our website. I think this is a study that could be useful for, you know, a region or a city who wants to look at multiple contaminated properties or look at landfills in a county. And finally, I'd like to tell you about some of the next steps at EPA. We just released a management plan that highlights a number of actions that will be taken over the next 2 years at EPA to move the Repowering America's Land initiative forward. So we're looking at expanding our toolbox of resources, specifically developing some guidance documents such as working with NREL to develop guidance on how to site solar PV on landfills. We're also looking to develop some guidance on siting renewable energy while cleanup is still ongoing, so that sites that have places that aren't contaminated and won't be a risk to human health can be developed while other parts of the site are being cleaned up. As I mentioned before, we're also working on developing more detailed case studies. This is the first in a webinar series. The next one will be in December and will provide information on assistance that Department of Energy has for local governments and states. We're also working to clarify liability protections so that those in the renewable energy world will understand how EPA and states address liability on contaminated sites. We're also looking to add other sites to our Google Earth tool. As I mentioned, most contaminated properties across the country aren't actually in the tool, and so we're looking to figure out how to add those sites. We'll probably start with some pilot states in a way that won't, overwhelm the user and the system. And finally, we're looking to expand our partnership with federal agencies such as DOE and, the other agencies that manage contaminated lands to look at how we can work to promote the concept of, looking at contaminated lands before green space for siting renewable energy. And on slide 17, you have my contact information. So thank you very much for listening to the introduction to Repowering America's Land. I'd now like to turn it over to Kevin Mayer of Region 9, who will tell you about the Aerojet site and EPA's work to have solar developed on part of that site while cleanup is still ongoing.
Thank you, Laura. This is Kevin Mayer, and I wanted to make a presentation on a very recent project involving currently 6 megawatts of photovoltaic power on the Aerojet Superfund site in Sacramento, California, or near Sacramento, California. Much of this work in putting together this presentation was the effort of Gary Riley, my co-RPM, who is very involved in renewable energy and green remediation. So let's move on to slide 19. And I would like to give a fairly brief overview of what this site is all about. There are some unique aspects of the Aerojet site that make this particularly positive for renewable energy, specifically photovoltaic. We'll talk about some of the motivations for moving towards sustainability and this specific solar energy project and a number of the factors that were involved in making this work and making this work successfully. On slide 20, you see a map here showing the proximity of Aerojet to the city of Sacramento, California's state capital. What you don't, well, probably this is a fairly good depiction of how flat it is, too. This is in the Central Valley, which gets very hot and sunny throughout most of the year. However, just 100 miles to the east is Lake Tahoe and the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So we're nestled in a very large central valley. On slide 21, there's a photo showing that it really doesn't appear to be that flat right there. that is an effect of some really remarkable land use toward the end of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century, where this site was dredge mined for gold. The American River was where gold was discovered initially, setting off the gold rush. But after this vast land was mined and frankly fairly messed up as far as being useful for farming anymore, operations from the Aerojet rocket manufacturing facility moved from Southern California to this large area in the early 1950s. Aerojet is still operating on this site today. On slide 22, you'll see a picture of this dredge that was initially floating in the river. It came up to the banks of the river and chewed up 50 to 100 feet depth of alluvial material with some gold, and all the cobbles and rocks were spilled out behind it as it moved miles inland from the riverbank, leaving this fantastic pattern, which really left piles. What you can't see is how deep these piles are. 5, 10, even 30 feet high piles of rocks and cobble. That piles of cobbles were useful for Aerojet in berming for blast protection and explosive material storage. They were also easy to flatten out for test stands and manufacturing areas. And the low areas in between were useful, at least useful as far as the corporation was concerned, for infiltration basins for processed wastewater and disposal of cooling and wastewater. The water infiltrated very nicely and contaminated huge amounts of groundwater. On the next slide, slide 23, it's a complicated map here, but the outline of the red line covers the groundwater contamination that led to EPA declaring this a Superfund site. That red outline encompasses approximately 27 square miles of land, and the contamination reaches down hundreds and hundreds of feet below the ground surface. If you look at the black arrows that indicate the groundwater flow direction, you can see that the Aerojet site is a recharge zone that is very useful for spreading the contamination quickly and in all sorts of directions. Let's move on to slide 24. So the land that used to be far away from any development, any towns, has now been enveloped by growing suburbs of Sacramento and Folsom and Rancho Cordova. Even though there's continued industrial operations, tenants and other facilities are moving up onto this property, Aerojet still wants to maintain some buffer zones, and EPA and the state of California are very intensely active in cleaning up this groundwater contamination. So some portions of the land has already been sold for future use in the idea that this will eventually become development of mixed residential and commercial areas. Like any type of reuse, planning renewable energy production at this site has to be compatible with the cleanup. And the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and the Green Remediation Program brought a number of tools to use to look at this potential for green remediation. Some more information on slide 25 gives you an idea of the time frame of the Superfund cleanup. It was listed as a national priority site in 1983. There is currently a huge amount of groundwater extraction and treatment systems going on. Let's move to slide 26. We've got 9 different operable units, each of which are in different stages. Moving along to slide 27, if you can make out those 9 red dots, those are centers of groundwater extraction and treatment systems that together are producing over 25 million gallons per day, pumping out of the groundwater hundreds of feet typically and running through treatment systems. More than 100 billion gallons of water have been pumped and treated since we started this work in the mid-80s. And as you can imagine, this involves huge amounts of power. Continuing on to slide 28, we have over 300 extraction wells that feed the 9 different groundwater treatment plants. Treatment for TCE, nitrosamine, NDMA, and perchlorate, particularly treatment for NDMA, involves very energy intensive UV oxidation, another drain on the power needs. Slide 29, the objectives for the groundwater treatment systems on the outer edge of the site have been established to protect the public drinking water supply and contain the contaminant plume where it is, and try to contain the high concentrations on site, thereby restoring groundwater between the source areas and the outer extent of contamination. The source areas on the property still are being developed, trying to figure out the best way to remove those sources of contamination over the long term. So, starting on slide 30, we talk about the sustainability initiative, where both EPA, the state of California, and even the Aerojet General Corporation, asked some basic questions about how we could reduce our environmental footprint while we are spending huge amounts of resources and using a lot of energy to clean up a very critical and valuable groundwater. If we can reduce the dependence on the grid and use a renewable and reliable energy source, we might actually create a win-win situation. On to slide 31. One thing is clear in planning a solar energy project in the Central Valley and at the Aerojet property, that there is a huge amount of property, starting with about 8,500 acres, currently down to about 6,000 acres of Superfund land. There are lots of areas where there is an opportunity to use renewable energy for the investigation and cleanup. We were very happy when Aerojet brought forward a plan for a solar project. But let's move on to slide 32 and talk about some of the considerations that came into being at at Aerojet. Aerojet, this, by the way, this slide was largely produced by the Aerojet Corporation, telling us their business considerations for structuring a deal to ensure viability and sustainability, determining who would actually own the solar project itself, how the land would be used, leased, or owned by Aerojet, the key power purchase agreement for any renewable energy project had to allow Aerojet to use or buy the power at acceptable rates for them and to make it a viable deal for the solar project owner. Funding for the project became very, very complicated. There are federal incentives, tax credits, and even direct payments. In California, as Lura mentioned, there are local initiatives to encourage use of renewable energy, and the local utility provided certain production-based payments and incentives, and the investors themselves had a combination of equity and debt financing. The third bullet there, the liability issues, really is critical on a Superfund site because the liability for cleanup is something that most investors really try to steer away from. However, indemnification goes both ways for Aerojet, indemnifying the liability from the solar power company, and the solar power company had to indemnify Aerojet for problems that they potentially could create with an easement agreement containing a long list of access provisions essential to both EPA and the state to make sure that our cleanup project and cleanup investigations weren't jeopardized. Two other points about business considerations. Although Aerojet intends to be at this location for the long term, at least that's what they've told us in Superfund, the groundwater cleanup will take many, many decades, probably centuries. Therefore, consideration of future land use after the life of the solar project was essential, and how the land and the other investments revert back to the landowner. And of course, there are multiple partners: Aerojet, Solar Power Inc., and the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. It was essential that they have a mutual agreeable project in a quick project timeline so that people didn't back out of this. On slide 32, the end consideration is of funding. Sacramento Municipal Utility District agreed to finance the majority of the project's $20 million cost over a 10-year period. There were many other financial and tax considerations, probably some of them that EPA and the state will never know about, to make this a very attractive business proposition for Aerojet General. So if we move on to slide 34, let's talk a little bit about the solar project timeline. According to Aerojet, it took about 8 months to figure out the options and work out the partnerships and ownership scenarios. There were a couple of months for developing the proposal, and adding on to that is negotiating the PPA, the prospective power purchase agreement. the formal contract. The first stage of construction took about half a year to build a bit less than 4 megawatts. And then the additional 2.4 megawatt photovoltaic system took another 6 months on a different part of the Aerojet Superfund site. On slide 35, we talk a little bit about the solar project as it was constructed. If you can see those the photovoltaic systems spread out over 40 acres, there are 30,000 individual photovoltaic solar panels. They're on a single axis tracking system, so they don't follow the sun across, but they can adjust to the height of the sun above the horizon. This size and this location had some constraints, not only on Aerojet's other needs and on the topography, but also they needed to avoid a highly contaminated area where we might be putting active extraction and treatment system for source areas. They had to avoid wetlands and protect it for flora and fauna. As you can imagine, with this much area virtually protected over the past century after it was chewed up by the mining, similar to a lot of military bases, there are areas where endangered flora and fauna have come to reside, and we now have to be careful about ripping those up. The design was flexible enough to create a footprint that worked with these issues. You can see how some of these areas are sort of established in odd arrangements. And it provided access to the existing electrical infrastructure on the Aerojet site, which needs to be upgraded for these new sources of power. This system is entirely with a secure perimeter, and because of those large cobble piles, the off-property appearance is somewhat minimized and becomes less of an attractive nuisance to trespassers. Moving on to slide 36, US EPA and our state counterparts were involved in the process, in the planning process throughout. The county was notified prior to the request for proposals. It was low impact construction. These systems are on concrete stands that are actually fairly small in footprint despite the large size of the photovoltaic systems above them. And these systems can be easily moved and relocated if need be, if the cleanup system must go into this area. There was reseeding with indigenous grass and wildflowers, and the wetlands were avoided. You can see in this picture on slide 36 some of the shrubbery where low areas provided enough water for woody plants to grow. We had remarkably positive response both internally and externally from the community. That is response from state, local, and federal agencies, and the Aerojet Corporation was very positive about it too. Moving on to slide 37, we have actually the specific mechanism for approving this project on the Superfund site. We have a partial consent decree that allows for certain land use with EPA and state approval. We insisted on access corridors in case we needed even to drill monitoring wells within this area. We mentioned future response actions, and our right of access is covered in this. Continuing on to slide 38, the system is providing perhaps a third of the power needed for the groundwater extraction and treatment. We're estimating that by using the PV, the photovoltaic system, we're avoiding thousands of tons of carbon dioxide as well as sulfur and nitrogen over the project's design life for the next 25 years. And the reuse plans for other portions of the site, typically farther to the west, which include residential and commercial mixed uses, can benefit from this expanded from this solar energy production and perhaps expansion of this PV system. And on slide 39, we really want to emphasize that partnerships, multiple partnerships, are essential for a successful system of this magnitude. You really need to involve stakeholders very early in the conceptual stage, and the flexibility to allow all the stakeholders to see some benefits from the system really helps smooth out the approval processes and the review processes, which even though Aerojet and its solar project partners were willing to make accommodations for siting and design, the timely action was very important to them to make sure that the capital does not go elsewhere in the face of time uncertainties. EPA was willing to ensure that this project could go forward as long as our goal of protection of human health and the environment wasn't jeopardized by a system that wouldn't allow us to get into this area if we needed to in the future. And my final slide on slide 40 acknowledges all the work that we got from and all the help we got from Aerojet General, the state of California, which unfortunately didn't make it onto this slide, and the EPA Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. You're welcome to contact Gary or myself if you have any questions in the future on other days. So thank you very much, and I guess Josh can take over from here.
Josh, just before you hop on the line, just a reminder, I have a number of questions that have been submitted online, and I thank everyone for doing that in advance. Again, if you'd like to, at any point, you can go ahead and click the question mark button if you're looking at the slides online and type up a comment or question. We do recommend you do that earlier rather than waiting until the end. That way we can have time to go through the questions. You can also, though, if you're on the phone lines, be assured we will take time unless you guys verbally ask those questions out loud. And with that, Josh, if you're ready to go on slide number 41.
Sure. I assume I'm off mute now.
You are indeed. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Gene. Thanks, Kevin. And so if everybody jumps on down to slide 41, you know, just the title slide so we can skip it. We can really skip number 42 as well because that's just an agenda. And I tell you real quick, all I'm really here to talk about today is a case study of the Steelwinds project, which is a 20-megawatt wind farm that I assisted in the construction and development of in Lackawanna, New York. My name is Josh Burkow. I'm a project manager with Apex Wind and Axio Power. On slide 43, you see the ownership structure here. It's Apex Wind and Axio Power are wholly owned subsidiaries of Greenlight Energy Resources. Greenlight Energy Resources owns Apex Wind, which does wind on brownfields, greenfields, and offshore wind. So we do the your traditional scenic vistas, farmlands, and middle of the country massive projects. We do brownfields like the Steelwinds project and everything we're here to talk about today. And then we also do bluefields. So we put wind turbines out in the water in the Great Lakes and in the Mid-Atlantic. Axio Power does a very similar thing, but for solar energy, specifically photovoltaics. We do greenfields, which is big, large projects out in the desert southwest, and smaller brownfield projects east of the Mississippi and in U.S. Pacific territories. We don't do offshore solar because, well, nobody's really figured out how to do that yet. Greenlight Biofuels, who I don't work for, is a biofuels company making biodiesel out of waste vegetable oil. And Columbia Power, who I also don't work for, is a technology company that is developing wave energy technology. So when we get to the end, feel free to ask me anything about wind or solar, but if you ask a question about biodiesel or wave energy, I'm just going to have to punt. Why do we really focus on brownfields? Is four reasons. We want to develop projects in months, not years. A wind project could take, a big one out in the middle of the country could take up to 5 years, depending on the regulatory climate you're building. And honestly, I hate to say it, a big solar project in the desert southwest, say California, could probably take the same amount of time. And so we're looking to speed up that process, and by using land that has few alternative uses, we think we can do that. We're looking for active or inactive sites, so mines, oil refineries, steel mills, oil fields, military bases, anything with a large institutional landowner. And so that could even be a site that in 50 years will be a mine, but isn't now and hasn't been in the past, somebody's reserves. We're looking to reduce our project costs, so cost of land acquisition, cost of infrastructure build, cost of getting anything out to the site. And we want to look green, and it's easier to look green if you're cleaning up a brown site, isn't it? Our strategy to do this is a little bit long-winded here, but the big thing here is that we just don't assume any liability for existing environmental contamination. We didn't create it. We don't particularly want to clean it up. If sometimes the economics work out that we do clean it up, but for the most part, we're in the business of developing energy projects, and we want to develop in a way that will facilitate the cleanup without taking on that responsibility ourselves. And that's bullet number two. We want to make sure that the site remediation does occur. We do not want to interfere with that, but as I said, it's not our bailiwick. We want to work on places where this is actually appropriate. I'd say if the site's too small, if the site's too environmentally sensitive, if the site's in the middle of central Manhattan where there's no wind resource, that's not an appropriate site. We want sites that can be built on immediately. And so if we have to go and remove the top 2 feet of dirt on the site and that's going to take 3 years, that's not a site we can build on immediately. And number five, we look at these almost as community and economic development projects more than we look at them as energy development projects. I'll talk about this a little bit later as we get to talk about steel winds, but redeveloping a brownfield has a massive effect on how a community feels about itself and how the outside world views that community. And to the extent that we can have a beneficial impact on that, that's one of the things that we're here to do. The last ones here are kind of six and seven are really things that we look for almost on any site. We want existing infrastructure. If I don't have to build a power line, I'd rather not. If I don't have to build a road, I'd rather not. I'm in the business of building wind turbines and solar panels and not building roads. The same thing with find a site with a large enough available land. I'm in the business of developing energy projects, not being a real estate broker. And so I generally go out looking for landowners who have all the land that I need under one name, and so I don't have to round up 600 landowners. If I had to do 600 landowners, well, I could just do a greenfield site. We want to work in states where there is a support for renewable energy development, either in terms of just a general policy at the executive level or a state renewable energy standard. We want to work cooperatively with the site owner. We're a green energy company. We don't really need a lot of good PR. We're going to look green almost no matter what we do. Whereas if our site owner is a steel plant or an oil refinery, they have very much an interest in looking a little bit greener than they are, looking a little bit greener at all. And then, of course, we only want to develop sites that support the long-term environmental status of the community. And so communities that have a long-term mission to look greener and to clean up their brownfield sites, that's the kind of thing we want to support. We've been generally successful with this so far. The first project the team worked on, and these are actually all under predecessor companies, so if you go and search out Apex Wind and Axio Power, or if you go and search out these sites, you find references to other companies working on them, and that's because the team members developed these either at other companies, or those subsequent companies were then subsequently acquired by Greenlight Energy. The Noreco project, 23 megawatts in an oil refinery in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, is developed by our senior executive VP, Paul Curran, when he was with Texaco. And once that project was successfully developed and operating back in the early part of this decade, he decided to come back to the U.S. and start a company to actually do that work. And that's where BQ Energy came about, which did the Steel Winds project, which I'm talking about later, and the Sunray Wind Farm, which was a partnership with Valero Energy Company, which is a 50-megawatt wind farm next to an operating oil refinery. It's in the, as opposed to being in the actual refinery, it's in the buffer lands, but it's providing energy to the refinery. BQ Energy was subsequently acquired by Greenlight Energy and then is now working as Apex Wind and Axia Power. The Fort Carson project was actually developed by Three Phases Energy, which is now a part of Axia Power. It's a 2-megawatt photovoltaic solar facility on a landfill at a U.S. military installation in Colorado. At the time, it was one of the largest PV facilities ever constructed on military land, and one of the largest ones ever done on a landfill. And unfortunately, I don't have the statistics on it, but I think it may still be the largest landfill solar project. And when we get to questions, if I'm wrong about that, somebody feel free to correct me. And as Axia Power, we're actually working on several landfill solar projects right now in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and happy to talk about that in the question and answer session if anybody has any questions about it. So what is a wind turbine, since that's largely what I'm here to talk about? Is a wind turbine essentially has three components. There's a tower, which is self-explanatory what that is. It's a tube of steel or concrete, and if you go out west and see some of the old projects from the 1970s, It could look like it's a lattice, like a radio tower or an oil derrick. But nobody uses lattice towers anymore in the United States. It's all tubular steel or a tube of concrete. Up on top of it, about 80 meters or 250 feet up in the air, you've got the nacelle. It's about the size of a small school bus. That's where all the action happens. It's the generator's in there. There's a gearbox. There's a lot of electrical and mechanical equipment that converts the actual motion of the wind into usable electricity. And then you've got the rotor, which is what actually catches the wind, which is, the rotor is about the size of a football field. So the total tip height is maybe 450 feet. And so if you think about it, you've got a football field rotating about a football field up into the air. And typically it's got three blades. They're made out of fiberglass, or in some cases now it's lacquered plywood. Some people are using, reinforced, carbon fiber, but it's a lot like the wing on an airplane or the propeller on an airplane, except it's fixed in place and just gets pushed around by the wind. The whole thing spins around 360 degrees to catch the wind no matter what direction it's coming. The blades themselves rotate around 360 degrees on their attachment points to either catch more of the wind or catch less of the wind. And these things have a minimum amount of wind they need to run. And after a certain point, you've got to shut them down because there's just too much wind, which is not a typical situation, but does happen. So when we're looking for a wind energy site, this is the general criteria we use. I haven't been telling you to switch slides here, but we're on slide 48 now. What we're looking for on a wind energy site, you'll see a wind map of the United States. And if you see the bright yellow and the red stuff in the middle of the country is the best wind resource in the country. And sometimes you'll hear people refer to their state as the Saudi Arabia of wind, and there are a lot of states that can claim that, and they all happen to be in the middle of the country, and so that's why you'll see all the really big renewable energy, or at least wind projects, are done in the middle of the country, because that's where the best wind resource is, and until recently, when all the transmission lines got completely used up out there, there was plenty of transmission, and so you could make super cheap wind energy all day and all night long and ship it out to the coast. Well, you can't do that so much anymore, so now we look for brownfield sites, and criteria that we use for them are, first and foremost, we want a state mandate for renewable energy. If we're building a project that's in a city, in really close to load, we want to use the renewable energy right there, and so we need a requirement for renewable energy right there. We want a clear and cooperative permitting process. The New York State has the SEACR process. California has something similar, federal lands have NEPA, Ohio has the Ohio Power Siting Board, and it's those are well-defined, well-regimented processes. We may not like all the hoops they have, that we have to jump through to do them, but you know what the process is starting out. We want a commercially viable wind resource. As you can see, the majority of that is in the middle of the country, but there are little pockets of good wind resource in almost every state in the union, with the exception really of the southeast. But almost everywhere else you can find a good enough wind resource on land to do a project. We want a good electricity market. We obviously need to sell our power to somebody, and it's a lot easier if as opposed to there just being somebody, there are multiple somebodies. And so we like to have a large market with a number of players, all of whom have a desire or a requirement to buy renewable energy. We look for on-site transmission lines, on-site substations. I don't really know how you're going to feel about wind energy, but some people like looking at wind turbines. Some people don't like looking at wind turbines. But it's pretty universal that nobody really likes looking at transmission lines, except for maybe electric power engineers like me. But most people don't want one of those in their backyard. Same thing with a substation. And so we prefer not to build them and look for places that already have them that we can make use of. As I said before, we're looking for a location near load. So that way, we need a transmission line, but then we don't really have to use it. We can just generate right there, and the energy is just used right there. Whereas if we just ship a long distance, sometimes there's a charge related to that. Sometimes you can get curtailment. And there's just all sorts of issues that go along with it that don't make us particularly happy. We're looking for access to road, rail, or port. We've got large components that we need delivered to our site. They come from all over the United States. They come from all over the world. And if you can bring something in by rail or by water, it's a lot easier than bringing it in by road, since wide loads, extra heavy loads, may have to wait for a state police escort. And realistically, we just want to get our stuff to the site, and no escorts are needed. You get all the permits beforehand if you're bringing something in by water or by rail. And so those are the two things we look for. We want local support for renewable energy. I've looked at mine sites before where you pull into town and there's big signs everywhere on everyone's lawn saying no wind turbines. And, you go and have your nice meeting at the mine and then turn around and leave and really never come back. If there isn't community support for renewable energy, it's not something we really want to deal with. We look to come in and I don't want to say be the heroes here, but we want to be well respected in the community. We want to respect the community and respect their wishes. And if they feel like renewable energy is not compatible with their community, then that's we'll accept that. We'll go on somewhere else. And then the last thing is a proper amount of available land. Minimum you really need for the type of project we look at is probably about 400 acres. And you can do more, you can do less. It depends on how much wind there is, which way the wind's blowing. Is it always blowing from one direction? And for instance, steel winds, which I'm going to get to on slide 49 just next, the turbines actually only take up 30 acres of about 1,200-acre site. And actually, let's jump on to slide 49 now. I can get past the intro stuff and just talk about the project. The steel winds project is a 20-megawatt project located in Lackawanna, New York. It's been running since 2007. It's the first 8 Clipper turbines that were installed in a commercial wind farm anywhere in the country. It's Clipper turbines are made in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, so it's a domestic content here. We successfully remediated the 30 acres immediately around the wind turbines, which is essentially the extent of our project footprint, which doesn't prevent the remainder of the site from being remediated. The whole site is about 1,200 acres and needs a lot more remediation than was needed at this 30 acres. So we went and we carved out the 30 acres that needed the least amount of work, redeveloped it, cleaned it up, put our project up, and went on with our lives and allowed the site owner to finish up the rest of the site. We got a large number of awards for this, including Renewable Energy Project a Year from Power Magazine International. Some firsts here: it's the first one on the shore of the Great Lakes. It's one of the most visible in the U.S. You can, if you're looking at the photo on slide 49 here, you can see the tallest building in the back there is HSBC building in downtown Buffalo, where the lawyers who helped us out with this project, Phillips Lytle, are located, and they can look out their window and feel good about the brownfield cleanup project they assisted us with. Pretty much whatever they want, because it's about the only thing you see when you look outside the HSBC tower is the Steel Winds project. And we like to think of it as the first urban wind facility in the U.S. we might be tied with that for the project in Atlantic City, but it's close enough, and you can see it from everywhere, and it's very accessible. The site itself is owned by ArcelorMittal Steel, and I'll get into it in a little bit, who they are and what they are and where they came from. If you jump on to slide 50 here, you can see where exactly the site's located. Lackawanna, New York is just south of Buffalo in the west coast of New York State on Lake Erie. It's and if you that's the road map on the left, the one in the center, you can see downtown Buffalo at the top. You can see downtown Lackawanna in the lower right, and where the Steelwinds project there is this little peninsula that sticks out off into the lake. And in a couple slides, I'll explain what that land is and how it got there. And if you look at the picture in the bottom right, you can see the land there is kind of dark brown and kind of gray and a little bit black. And you may be wondering why that is, and that's the topic of slide number 51. The history of this site is that it was originally owned by the Lackawanna Steel Company. In 1900, it was the Lackawanna Iron and Steel Company based out of Scranton, Pennsylvania. They got into a little bit of dispute with the local government, and they said, local government, back off or we're going to move the plant. And the local government said, nah, you're not going to move the plant. And, well, Lackawanna Company moved the plant. They moved it to what would eventually become Lackawanna, New York. But in 1903, when they began operations up there, it was an unincorporated area of Erie County. In 1909, they formed the city of Lackawanna, named after the steel company and right around the steel plant. Essentially, it was a company town, though it's an official city, but pretty much everybody there worked at the steel plant. 1910 to 1921 showed an expansion of the steelworks until it took up the 2 miles of shoreline that you saw in the in slide 50. So if you just jump back a sec, that 1,200-acre site there, it's about 2 miles long. All of it at one point was an integrated steelmaking facility. So back to slide 51 here. It was acquired by the Bethlehem Steel Company out of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania in 1922. Bethlehem Steel is one of the more famous steel companies in the country, as it's a spectacular failure in the 70s and 80s. In 1945, this site was the largest integrated steelmaking facility in the world. 20,000 people worked there. And following mostly after the Vietnam War and through the late 70s and the middle of the 80s, really de-investment in an underinvestment in U.S. steelmaking facilities and foreign competition, and specifically foreign companies just getting better at making steel and using a lot of our practices, caused a shut-in of a lot of steel facilities in the United States, including the obsolescence of the Lackawanna Steelworks. In 82, Bethlehem Steel shut it down, laid off 16,000 people. Some operations remained there. There was an anodizing mill. The coke works was still there. Some pumps were still running, but largely the integrated steelmaking facility was gone. And in 1988, they declared it a Superfund site following a RCRA facility assessment. And now, why is it that it's a Superfund site is something that I'll cover on the two slides after this one. The 83 to 2001, it was restructured, and specifically Bethlehem Steel was restructured, and everything was consolidated at three sites. 2001, Bethlehem Steel filed for bankruptcy and was bought by International Steel Group. In 2005, before the merger of ISG with Middle Steel, VQ Energy approached ISG about redevelopment of this site as a wind energy facility. And as I said, the project went online in 2007. And so, as you see, the site had essentially three owners in that time. ISG merged with Middle Steel, and in 2006, Middle merged with Arcelor to form ArcelorMittal, which is still the largest steel company in the world. In 2009, the anodizing mill across the road from this site was finally shut down due to the recession, and so now all steelmaking operations have now ceased in Lackawanna. If you jump to slide 52, you see a picture of the site as it was in 1903, and I'm only showing you this slide so you can see where the ship canal is then and where Lake Erie was then. If you jump to slide 53, you see what the size of the site looks like now and why this is a contaminated and a Superfund site. Ship canal hasn't moved, but the coast of Lake Erie has. They essentially created 440 acres of land in the lake. There's a byproduct of steel production called steel slag. And it's basically the leftover rocky, non-metallic ore that was in the iron ore, that was in coal, and any of the other materials that go into steelmaking. And it's a leftover material. These days we found it's an excellent fill material, so you can crush it up and use it for road beds and put it under houses. It doesn't have a lot of trace metals in it. But back then it was just a massive byproduct that they had no real use for. And so those large integrated steelmaking facilities, if they were in the middle of the country, would just generally dump it in pits or just pile it up as a tailings pile. Here on the Great Lakes, where you've got this body of water, they just threw it in the lake. And so there's this strip of land, maybe 2 miles long, maybe half a mile to three-quarters of a mile wide in some areas, that's sticks up maybe 20 to 30 feet above lake level. That's all steel slag. And you see that on slide 54 on the right side. That's taken down at the beach, and you can see where the regular ground level is above lake level. On the left side of there, you can see what actually you find if you dig in here, and it's the reason this is a Superfund site is because they just dumped everything and anything in there. They were dumping steel slag, but if you look closely, there's rusted bits of metal, some electrical cable, I see some rope in there, and just generally nondescript junk was all chucked into the lake. And so that did present some problems for us insofar as construction of a wind facility, in that nobody had ever really built a wind farm on this before. There's a, much to our surprise, there actually was an international group dedicated to the study of the structural properties of steel slag, largely because there's so much steel slag in the world, you've got to figure out something to do with it. And we were able to make contact with them and learn how to actually build and work on this stuff. Specifically for construction of the wind farm itself, essentially you dig a big pit and you fill it with concrete. That's a wind turbine foundation. And it is more complex than that. It is an engineered structure, but largely it's a pit full of concrete. You dig your holes. If you go down about 15 feet, you make a 60-foot diameter, 15-foot thick block of concrete with a small post coming out of the top, and then you backfill it. Because the site did have tons of rubble in there, we did have to do real excavation. We pulled out everything that was in there. Anything hazardous that was found was sent to hazardous waste landfills. Anything that was just rubble or recyclable materials was sent off to be recycled. Anything that was just waste was essentially sent on to the appropriate landfilling facilities. Once you backfill this thing, you essentially get a 15-foot diameter circle above ground with a bunch of anchor bolts sticking up, and you see that in the bottom right corner of slide number 55. In some spots, we had to do dynamic compaction because, as I said, they just kind of dumped almost anything in here, and so you didn't really have a uniform medium everywhere. In most spots, you did, and as I said, steel slag is essentially rock, so it's a great building material, but unless you have a uniform material, you've got to go in and pound the stuff down. And there are a couple spots where there was other material in there, and so we had to do dynamic compaction to level out the site. And there was also removal of surface debris as well. I didn't show any photos of what the top of the ground looked like when we got out there, but in addition to there being tons of stuff buried down in the steel slag, there was just rubble and rail cars and rusted bits of metal and just years of dumping from the abandonment of the site that was there as well that needed to be cleaned out. Construction of the wind farm itself, once we've got the 15-foot circle above ground, is pretty simple, and it's except for the size of the equipment involved, it's a lot like an erector set. The lower in the tower sections and grout them down to the base and bolt them down, which you see the top left photo, and the bottom left photo right above the number 56, you can see what a tower base looks like. There's wind turbine towers essentially have three or four sections depending on the turbine height and who the tower designer is. These ones, as I said, were 250 feet tall. And so you stack the pieces one on top of the other. And in the bottom, the top right, you can see another tower section being moved into place. And in the bottom right, you see the fully erected tower with the nacelle on top, which is the little bit that looks like a school bus. Then you can see that they're lifting the rotor all the way up to connect it. And this is a typical construction method on land where you've got all the space in the world around you, is that you assemble the entire rotor on the ground, all three blades and the hub that the blades connect to, and lift it all as one piece. if you don't have a lot of space to move around and lay everything out, say if you're doing an offshore project or if you're on a ridge line or it's just a small site that you can't clear or has large ground disturbances, you can actually lift all those pieces individually and bolt them on. And if you look at the bottom right, you may be able to see if you've got good eyesight, but there's actually a guy riding up on the rotor. It's not a job I'd like to have. It's a development timeline for this was about 2 years. And if you recall back to the beginning of the presentation, I had said that it could take 5 years to do a traditional greenfield project. And an offshore project, the most notable one, Cape Wind, has already taken 10 years. And so we're well ahead of the curve on this project with a 2-year development timeline. And construction was usually about 3 to 6 months. We had delivery delays of components, which led to weather delays, since we built in one of the coldest and windiest winters on record in Buffalo. And so it actually ended up taking us 6 months to construct because equipment delays led to weather delays. I guess I won't get into some of the horror stories, but there are definitely some horror stories during the construction of this facility that nothing bad, just all weather stuff.
Josh, I'm just going to interject real quickly on just a time check to let you know we've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay, well, I'll speed through the rest of the stuff.
Great, thank you.
Okay, the general experience with state and federal agencies is that the people at the top want to see renewable energy development on brownfield sites, and the EPA has wonderfully put together a part of its organization to promote this. But in the past and in a lot of state groups, you find that the people at the top want it to happen, the renewable energy group wants it to happen, but there are conflicting requirements of the three parts of the agency, and that each one of them has their priorities that typically lead to a project getting built when the site is fully remediated and ready for redevelopment. But thanks to the EPA Repowering America's Lands Program, and in the case of the Lackawanna Project, actually the New York State Brownfields Cleanup Program, you can now move ahead quicker on this without interagency coordination issues, because there are programs in place to parallel remediation and redevelopment at the same time. And in the case of Lackawanna, we got tax credits for doing that. The impediments to actually doing this, the biggest one is that site owners, who are the ones who are actually usually paying for remediation, don't want to pay for it. They want to put it off as long as possible, preferably until after the current CEO has retired. And so the site owners want to delay. Often they have no real incentive to allow this. And in some cases, the remediation department, which is in charge of this, looks at this and says, well, as long as we're remediating this, we still have jobs. If we finish the remediation, then what do we do? And so there's the trick of figuring out how you get your site owner to actually want to do this in an expeditious manner. You've got to keep the investors happy as well and make sure that they have no exposure to liability. And that's something that we've become quite expert at. And then the cost advantage of a brownfield versus a greenfield, it varies state by state. And in a down market like it is today, is there a cost advantage? In some places there still is, but a number of markets in the middle of the country, the cost advantage isn't as clear right now, and so there's a lot of work you need to do as a private developer to understand that. And I'll just skip the suggestions for agency action, and we can just tie it up and go to questions and discussion.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. I have a number of questions that have come in online, but before we switch over to those, I am going to ask those of you who are on the phone lines, if you have a question, we'll take one of them from the phone lines, and then I'll switch over and start going through the ones online. If you're on the phones and you'd like to ask a question directly to the speakers, you can hit #6 to take your phone off of mute. Okay, I don't hear anything immediately coming in on the phone, so I'm going to start with the streaming simulcast questions that were submitted online. The first one comes in from Portland, and they ask, why are there no solar potential sites listed in Massachusetts? They're aware of good incentives in Massachusetts.
Yeah, this is Lura. When we originally did our policy map, I think it was back in December of 2009, and so I recently heard that Massachusetts did enact solar policies this past year. So we're working on updating those. Check back on our website. Probably within the next couple of weeks, we'll have a state-specific map for Massachusetts, and also our U.S. map will now contain the solar site. So I think that adds about 40 properties.
Okay, great. And I think somewhat related to your section of the presentation, Laura, there's a question that came in from Puerto Rico, and they ask if you could briefly describe how the sites presented in slide number 7 were selected. And then more specifically, they want to know how can they get to the Excel spreadsheet listing the sites under this initiative.
Well, the spreadsheet that has all the sites is on the Repowering website, epa.gov/renewable-energy-land, and the Excel spreadsheet is under Data Information tab on the left. We selected these sites. We have lat-long data for about 11,000 contaminated properties across the country, so we worked with NREL to screen those sites for solar that, number one, have solar potential, good solar potential, or number two, are in states with those solar set-aside policies.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. The next question is also coming in from Portland, and they ask, does the Aerojet system require the utility T&D system to power extraction systems located off-site, and is the project considered a utility?
Can you hear me? I'm not sure that I'm even on
yep.
the phone. Okay, great. There's a lot more energy draw than the PV system can produce. Generally, what happens is that the power goes into the grid and gets purchased basically by the utility district. And then Aerojet gets credit for that in its purchase of other power to operate throughout the year and throughout the diurnal cycle. I guess there were some other aspects to that question, but I'm not sure if I understood what they were.
Well, again, I'll read it out loud. They ask, does the Aerojet system require the utility T&D system to power extraction systems located off-site, and is the project considered a utility?
The project itself is not considered a utility, no. It's got a partnership with the utility district. And, no, there's no particular requirement that the power produced is used to power any particular part of the treatment system.
Okay, great. The next one comes in from Philadelphia, and they state, wow, 6 megawatts only provides 30% of your power needs. Are there any plans to increase capacity to export and provide power to the grid?
There are some plans, but my understanding is that they're going to see how this 6 megawatt works and how the incentives, the actual business incentives, play themselves out over the next couple of years. And yes, indeed, 30 million gallons a day, uses up a tremendous amount of energy. One of the reasons why EPA, in our region is so anxious to move forward to reduce our environmental footprint for this remediation. The water is just so expensive, though, and so valuable in this part of the country.
Thanks. The next question, also referring to the Aerojet site, is coming in from Princeton, New Jersey, and they ask, with the use of the heat in the extracted groundwater in a groundwater, i.e. open-loop, ground source heat pump system considered?
It wasn't considered, and generally I'm not sure exactly what the temperature difference is. During much of the year, the surface temperature is extraordinarily warm in the Central Valley, so the subsurface temperature is only has a certain amount of extractable heat energy, but basically no. This was a system that the photovoltaic system was ready to go, and other more exotic green remediation systems were not very greatly considered at all.
Okay, this is the next question comes in from Tempe, Arizona, and also again referring to Aerojet. They ask what NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, and or CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, was undertaken. While this project did occur on private property and would not be typically subject to such environmental review, wouldn't EPA's participation, in other words, Fed funds and the Superfund classification, create the necessary trigger for NEPA compliance?
Lura might be able to expand on this, but essentially, being an NPL site, we are conducting the equivalent of a NEPA in the decision-making process. So one of the advantages that I don't think we emphasized here was that both NEPA and the state equivalent, CEQA, are not very onerous at this site. So as long as EPA approves the project as part of the cleanup, we can move forward with it without going through the more formal steps. One thing, though, we do have a tremendous amount of information on the water, the soil, the plant and animal communities here because of the Superfund remedial investigation work. So we were pretty confident in being able to move forward that we would not disrupt the environment.
Great. The next question comes in from Thousand Oaks, California, and I do understand we're just hitting our suggested conclusion time. I'm going to extend it on just a few minutes more to get through the questions that we have before we formally close everything out. So I appreciate everybody's patience to stay with us for a few more moments. And again, the next question online, if you are streaming, you can go ahead and keep typing them in. We still have a few more minutes to answer questions. They ask, what was the timing on the expansion of the toolbox of resources giving guidance for solar and wind projects on closed landfills? Or what is the timing on the expansion?
Sure. We are hoping to get out the guidance for siting solar, and it will just be solar because wind often doesn't make sense on landfills because you can't pierce the cap in April of 2011.
Great, thank you. The next question, I think, Josh, this one might have been fielded over to you, coming from Austin, Austin, Texas, that is. They ask, what are the geotechnical stability obstacles to constructing a solar PV on a landfill? In other words, how do the project developers overcome potentially unsturdy ground?
Sure, happy to answer that. For PV, generally, if you're expecting settlement to occur at your landfill, you probably wouldn't do a PV facility there. When we're doing PV, we look for facilities that have been closed on the order of 5 to 10 or longer. And by closed, I actually mean inactive. And if it's been active for 10 years and you just closed it last year, you're not going to see a lot of settlement on the landfill. But if everything just shut down last year and was capped immediately afterward, you're probably going to want to wait for a while. Most PV equipment available right now only handles about 6 inches of differential settlement on any axis. I just talked to a guy who built a wind farm on a landfill in Germany, and I think he got about 1.5 meters of settlement in 3 years. And so that's not going to do very well for your PV system. And you'd have to put in some expensive hydraulic adjustment systems that, to be perfectly honest, just aren't economic for a PV facility.
Okay, great. The last question that I have online right now, and if you do have anything, go ahead and try to squeeze it in very quickly before I check with the phone lines for final comments or questions. I asked in reference to using the materials that the instructors have shared today. Some of the participants have been interested in distributing the PowerPoint presentations or perhaps having hyperlinks back over to these materials and this seminar, and they want to know if there's any problems using that material or referring back to this presentation.
No, not for me.
Yeah, this EPA material from the Aerojet is you're welcome to use it's public information.
Okay, and excellent. And of course, just from the Kluent perspective, our internet seminars are free and open to the public, so you are more than welcome to refer people back to the seminar homepage as well as the resources that we've made available here. You can hyperlink over to that site. It's there for your resource and your reference. I did have one more question that came in online coming in from Pittsburgh, and they ask, what are the top five states for solar-based on incentive programs?
Josh, do you want to field that one?
Yeah, sure. The top one is California, where there's so much sun and power is so expensive that solar is actually almost at grid parity right now. Following that, probably New Jersey is next, which is that's why there's so much explosive growth in New Jersey. And then going from there, couldn't really tell you. New Jersey and California are really at the top two, with California at the top. And then it really just depends on how you're planning to go about the market as to whether one state or another of the other incentive states are good or not. Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware have great programs. Massachusetts is a great program. Arizona, New Mexico, you can get close to grid parity. Same with Nevada. It just depends on what your development strategy is for the other states.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to switch back over to the phone lines. If anybody on the phone lines has a comment or question for the instructors, remember I globally muted everybody. So in order to have us hear you, you're going to have to hit #6, and then you can feel free to ask a question or make a comment directly to our speakers. Okay, I don't hear any final comments or questions coming in from telephone participants. I don't see anything else coming in from the online. So with that, I'll just double check and see if any of our instructors have any closing statements or remarks they'd like to make, starting with Laura.
Thanks everyone for calling in, and our next webinar will be in December, so check back on the Repowering website or to clue in for more details on that.
And Kevin?
Well, I just wanted to reiterate that a project of this size really is a collaborative effort that takes positive momentum from so many parties that you need to keep communicating. So thank you very much for listening.
And Josh?
I don't have anything to add, but thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for listening.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'm going to direct everyone to the final slide in the materials that were presented today, which is slide number 61. And on that slide, you will find two important links. These very same links, though, can be found on the seminar homepage as well as the bottom. The first link is an additional resource page where you'll be able to download today's PowerPoint materials as well as take a look at a few other related resources. There are also links on that page if you are interested in learning more about these types of free internet seminars. There are links to sign up to be notified for future sessions as well as look at archived Kluent seminars that we've offered in the past. The second link on slide number 61 is our short feedback evaluation form. I'd encourage everyone to take just a minute to fill that out and let us know what you thought of today's session. You can also, if you'd like, when you fill out that feedback form, check a box to have a confirmation email sent to you for your records. While we don't offer CEUs or PDHs, occasionally the accrediting organizations will take a printout of the materials, a registration email, and a feedback confirmation email to verify that you did indeed attend and did complete and provide feedback for the session. So with that, I'm going to thank the over 120 individuals that joined us from around the country today. I hope that you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time. I'd also like to extend my thanks to our instructors today for putting their materials together and as well taking time out of their busy schedules to present this information. As Laura mentioned, this is only the first one in a multi-part seminar series that's going to take place over the next few months on Kluent. So if you did find this to be a valuable resource, please know that you will receive an automated email as soon as the archive for this session is available. You can download it and replay it in a variety of formats. And again, also to be sure to check for the next session that will be delivered in the seminar series. To participate in a future Kluent seminar, simply visit kluent.org/training and take a look at what we have scheduled in the future. So again, thank you all for joining me today, and I hope to hear from you on the future Kluent seminar. This is the formal conclusion of today's session. I hope you have a great rest of the day.